Stop letting people talk you out of your power.
How do we build a movement that allows us to respond to all the names that people don't know?
People begin to think it's isolated. That's the problem. We're not angry enough.
This is Life After the Impact, a podcast for impacted families by impacted families that focuses on what happens after the media, the lawyers, and the activists are gone.
When the cameras are gone, people leave. We have to be there for each other.
Impacted families are left to face the loss of a loved one to police-sponsored violence. We will focus on their continued fight for justice and how you can get involved.
I tell families, you know, fight.
Everybody can do something, that you don't have to sit home and feel helpless and hopeless.
We got to stop allowing people to talk us out of our power. That's the main thing. Can't change overnight. But we gotta start somewhere. Might as
well go ahead, start here. We didn't. Good evening. My name is Roxanne Johnson. And before we get started and introduce our wonderful guest tonight, I would like for us to take a moment of silence to lift up the name of our sister, Sonia Massey, who was killed by police. We're just gonna take a moment of silence. Ashe, we trust and believe, pray for her family, and we pray that her journey into the ancestral realm is smooth and peaceful. Gone too soon, another life stolen. Again, my name is Roxanne Johnson. My son was killed by DC Metropolitan Police October the 1st, 2019. I'm here with my wonderful co-host, Latoya Benton. Good evening, Latoya.
What's up, you guys? Good evening, you all. My name is Latoya Benton. I am the mother of the fabulous Xavier Hill, who was taken from me at the age of 18, January the 9th, 2021, at the tender age of 18. Tonight, we are going to have a very, very, very important conversation. As you can see, we're going to have one third guest to join us soon, but right now we're joined. I'll let them give their own introduction of themselves. Zoe, you want to start off, please?
Hey, family, thank you for having me. I am Zoe Spencer, now Harris, a professor of sociology at Virginia State, and an activist and social advocate.
All right. Angelo, you?
Yes, thank you so much. So Angelo Pinto, organizer, activist, attorney. I'm a co-founder of an organization called Until Freedom, which is an intersectional social justice organization that did a lot of work around justice for Breonna Taylor. The activist in residence at Yale University and an adjunct professor at Seton Hall University.
Right, we got the professors in the house this evening. We're so happy to have you, and thank you for accepting our invitation this evening. We want to get our audience in step and get them to have a very good understanding on why in this particular time in history that our vote is so important. And we want to get a good understanding of what it means to vote, because some of us have different ideas about the whole idea of voting. So either one of y'all want to take that, go for it.
Professor Harris, go ahead, dive in. I'll follow you.
You can just call me Zoe. Let me go back, because I am a product of Berry Farms Projects in Southeast DC. And so the accolades, you know, after we accomplish stuff, it sounds good, but who I really am, that's my foundation. I went to school at Howard. All of my degrees are from Howard, and I am not going to lie. And I want people to understand, I wasn't a voter. I was one of the ones who I'm like, you know, it doesn't matter, Democrat, Republican, whatever. it doesn't matter. The systems are still the same. It's designed to preserve itself. And I'm not voting. And so, you know, people going to look at me crazy, but I didn't start to vote until I think it was probably 2008. So I get that. I get where people who are conscious and people who understand, you know, systemic and institutional racism and the way that those things are sustained in our political system, I get it. This is different. We're in a different time right now. And you know, if you research and you study like history and the trajectory, the way things have been evolving, you'll see a pattern. And right now, I know that we are at a crossroads. And as we were talking before, this is do or die. And before we even get to voting, I would encourage your listeners to research Project 2025, which is absolutely imperative, and to understand the Heritage Foundation, the leader of the Heritage Foundation, their agenda, and understanding Project 2025's agenda, because I know that, and I have known for a while, I've taught it for a while, I've projected it for a while, I just never thought it would happen in my lifetime, that the plan is for Black people to go into a state of, to be pushed into a state of regression back to Jim Crow. That's the agenda. And it feels good because we have some semblance of freedom now. But if you look at the rulings, the Supreme Court rulings, as it relates to women, as it relates to, I'm going to say Black people, brown people as well, all of the repressions that have occurred right here, the goal is to put us back to Jim Crow. And mass incarceration as a form of slavery, the goal is to increase mass incarceration to provide a free labor supply for America. And I'm going to stop there, Brother Angelo, because I know you have things to say, but I'm going to stop at it is do or die time. And so I'm at a state right now where I understand the importance of voting in this moment for our community in particular.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, there's so many layers and so much to all of what's going on this particular moment. And, you know, me too. I remember the first time I even thought about voting, I was in college and I was learning, it was Bush Gore. And I was, you know, which was such an interesting election, as so many of the presidential elections are. But it was the first time where I had became politically aware and politically educated about voting and whether or not it was important. And I was at an HBCU, I was at Norfolk State University. And, you know, speaking with Black young people across the country about whether or not we should vote. This was also the same year that the Million Family March happened. And I remember we went to DC before we took a bus from Norfolk State there. And, you know, like many people in college, I became probably radicalized. And that's when I first heard about mass incarceration. Like, I heard about everything there. Kimba Smith came to Norfolk State because she had just been pardoned by Bill Clinton. So I was learning about all these things at the time. And it was really a moment where, even at that moment, I still wasn't convinced that I should vote. Even though all those things were happening around me, I was being radicalized, made aware of these things that I had already experienced. So many of my family members had already been incarcerated. I had already been arrested. My brother was prosecuted as an adult in New York State. So I had already experienced mass incarceration, policing, all the system kind of feet on the back and necks of Black people. I experienced it all. I didn't necessarily know the technical and the ideological understanding of the structures, philosophy. I didn't know any of that. But I had the real-time lived experiences. So once I learned those things, I was like, oh, this is what that is. This is what's happening to my folks. But again, I still didn't know if I should vote. And I still didn't understand the importance of voting. I didn't even know who was really running for anything outside of the presidential election as well, right? So one of the big pieces, the more I've become kind of politically sophisticated, is that, and we say, folks say this all the time in the movement, is that all politics are local. So one of the things that I think is tremendously important, and the presidential election kind of gives folks the opportunity to refocus, is to really pay attention to what's happening in local politics. And that's what I always engage folks I work with, students around, is like, do you know who your elected officials are? Like, locally, do you know the city council folks who represent you? Do you know your mayor? And I work with a lot of high school students, and they're like, no. So part of it, and the reason why I tell them that's important, is that maybe you want to run for office, right? You're 18, about to be 19, or about to be 18, about to be 21, and you care about the issues in your community. You're experiencing the issues in your community. One, you should understand politics, because it's not that politics will solve all of our problems. I tell people this all the time. I don't think politics and even policies solve all the Black folks' problems, right? But it's a power structure that does do certain things. Mm-hmm. And we should have an understanding and relationship with that power structure, mm-hmm. and understand what we want to do with it. How do we utilize our power as we engage this power structure, right? And I think for folks at all the different age ranges, that means something different. But I think particularly for all of us, it means how to reclaim power. One of the speeches that I always go back to when I'm thinking about politics is Malcolm's The Ballot of the Bullet. I always go back to the speech. I listen to it. I make people listen to it. Because in that speech, Malcolm is talking about Black nationalism as an ideology. But he's talking about Black nationalism really as a tool to engage politically. Right. He's saying in this speech that Black folks oftentimes were politically unsophisticated, and as a result, were used by the political apparatus. Because there's no group, particularly when you look at the Democratic Party, that votes more Democratic than us. I mean, we loyal like you couldn't imagine. Black people are more loyal than Black men, right? The Democratic Party, right? And even when we look at what's happening with VP Harris right now, she's had record raises financially, which I didn't think was going to happen, right? But a lot of this is being fueled by Black folks.
Yeah. Right?
We're the economic engine of this. We're no longer even the political engine of the party, which we have been, but now we're the economic engine, which is mind-blowing to me in so many ways. But back this Ballot of the Bullet speech, what Malcolm is saying is, don't be political pawns.
Yes.
And have a political ideology, he says, Black nationalism, that galvanizes Black folks and makes us behave and act in a particular way politically. Right. And he says some of the reason Black folks are politically disengaged is because we don't have candidates that share our interests, that really care about us. They might look like us, mm-hmm. but even some of the ones who look like us don't care about us, don't share our interests. But the philosophy of Black nationalism and having a clearer Black agenda will allow us to now have the kind of candidates that represent our interests and desires. And then we have the political base to decide who or who isn't a candidate. And that should be, that political power should allow us to create social change in our communities. That's kind of the connection. We build our political power through this philosophy that allows us to get candidates in positions. We get candidates in positions to shift the social circumstances of our community and the economic circumstances of our community. If we don't engage politically from that perspective, we end up running the risk of just being pawns. And our economics, now we're seeing the economic engine behind the Harris campaign, and even our vote ends up being utilized and marginalized to serve the agenda of others.
Right, and not ourselves.
That's the last thing. That's the biggest risk we run all the time, even now.
So as you're saying that, how do we get back to the basic education then? Before you got on the call too, we're talking about just how do you get back to... Okay, so myself, I didn't
Uh-oh, she froze. She's saying that she didn't, I think she just started voting out while she's coming back on. I think at the basis of what we're talking about when we're talking about voting is the exchange of power, you know, and to get people to understand that, you know, she's back from being frozen, but to be able to understand. And what we say on this call all the time is that voting is just one tool in our toolbox. It ain't the end all to be all, but we got to have our hand in that pot in order to see some traction, because again, the bottom line is about the distribution of power.
Exactly. So I was going to say real fast, I started voting until last year or two years ago, like literally, okay? I didn't grow up voting, right? I didn't grow up voting. I didn't grow up learning about politics, any of that stuff. That was always just prayed away. You know what I mean? You don't vote. You know what I mean? You more so, you take your problems to God, and that's how it's supposed to be handled. But what I learned as I got to be an older adult and I'm paying taxes and stuff, I'm like, hold on now, wait a minute. My money is going here. I do have a voice to say something, and I need to say something. So how do we, like you said again, how do we get back to this, not just the, because, you know, everyone's hype right now because they're looking at the presidential election. But once this goes over with or not, how do you get people to, you know, be educated that your vote goes beyond that? It goes beyond into the school boards. It goes to your mayor, to your governors, all those things that are controlled by our day-to-day lives. It's not just people just getting being killed by the police. It's how your lives are moved every single day. So how do we get people to understand on that portion of it, that it comes from the voting, that that's how we have to, like, connect those two? How do we get there?
So, well, I mean, I think there is a quote where John Lewis said that the vote is the most powerful nonviolent tool we have to use in this democracy. But there are others who go further and say the opposite. They say the vote is important, but in terms of being civically engaged, the vote is the easiest or the weakest thing you can do. Right. And that true civic engagement goes much further beyond a vote. Uh-huh. And that's what you're talking about. Like, to cast the ballot and never look at anything else, to never be engaged at your school board, to never understand what the community board is, to not know who the elected officials are, to not have an agenda for those elected officials. In many ways, you might be throwing your vote away.
About pretty much.
Your vote has to be connected, and I think that's what Malcolm was saying, to a political philosophy. Ideally, a political philosophy that your community shares, and that political philosophy then holds all of the other elected officials accountable from the bottom up. And that means you have to be aware of who they are. You should attend some of those meetings. Uh-huh. You should be clear about what your agenda is for these individuals. I did a political training in North Carolina the other day. We were in Eastern North Carolina. I can't even remember the county. But one of the things that we were talking about was, because now what's happening in this political climate is people are paying very close attention to swing states, uh-huh. right? They're paying close attention to the states that could be red, could be blue. Right. We don't know what's going to happen with them. And North Carolina is one of those states, a lot of black folks throughout the state. And now they're beginning to mobilize black folks to say, hey, we need you for election time. Right. But one of the things when I go to the community and I was speaking to folks, the community, the issues in black communities are almost identical. We're dealing with this police misconduct, mass incarceration issues, employment issues, education issues, housing issues. We're dealing with almost the same issues. And unfortunately, we've been dealing with a lot of these issues for decades and decades and generations, which means as we've been engaged in the political process, because we have been, and we're Democratic loyalists, right? We haven't received the benefits to the work we've put in.
Uh-huh.
We haven't received the benefits. So there's something we must do differently now in order to receive the kind of benefits I believe that are equal to the kind of work we've done politically, right? But I think that requires us to become more politically sophisticated and get very clear about what we want. I mentioned in this training, Martin Luther King, right? And I talked about, I asked them about the I Have a Dream speech. And I asked many people, students this too all the time. I said, what are the first words of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, or the first couple of sentences? And most people say, I have a dream. I'm like, nah. Martin didn't start talking about the dream to the end of the speech. And what he started talking about was the economics of what's happened to Black folks and how he's going to Washington, D.C. for a check, right? So I was saying to folks also, leaders like Martin, they have been co-opted, right, to have a watered-down political message. When these individuals had a very clear, powerful political message with very specific asks, and a lot of the asks were economic, right? He was saying at the time, we passed Civil Rights Act, we're passing these pieces of legislation, but when there isn't dollars connected to them, in many ways, they have no power at all, which is why he was saying, we're going to Washington, D.C. to get our check. But he said, our check, unfortunately, has been marked insufficient funds. So now that we've done all these things politically, we've moved all of these things, we can't actually get the resources and the political support to implement these things and really create social change for our communities. So saying all that to say, I think from the most local level, all the way through the president, we have to be clear about what our agenda is as Black folks, what we want them to do, how we want them to do it, and even a timeline of implementation. And I think that's often the thing that goes missing. And the last thing I'll say to this point is, what's happening with VP Harris, it reminds me a lot about what happened with Obama. Like, Black folks got very excited, as we should have, right? We're seeing ourselves for the first time in that kind of position. But one of the challenges, and I think the political apparatus is very sophisticated at doing this, is they know how to use Black folks.
Yes.
They know how to use Black folks. And they know they're in a moment of tremendous need. Joe Biden possibly could not have pulled off a win in the election. I didn't think he could. I think now they have hope, right? And not only do they have hope, they got money. They got Black people's excitement because of the symbolism. But what could get lost for us is the substance of what we want.
Right.
My thing I keep telling folks is, as we are excited about the symbol, because even I'm excited, I ain't gonna lie, excited about the symbol, how do we make sure the substance comes through? Mm-hmm. How do we make sure we get the substantive things we want, and we don't just start running behind the bandwagon and throwing everything else to the wind? We have to be very clear and make sure we get our agenda pushed, be clear about what our agenda is. Otherwise, you will have a situation where you have someone who looks like you in one of the highest offices of the world, as we did with Obama, and you don't get much in return. And that's no good.
So you want to chime in on that? Yeah, I could go into a whole deep analysis of, you know, Black people's interest and you know, what the system is designed to do, but I'm gonna hold it. But I do want to go back to the local elections, because I think that's really, really important. I don't think that people understand how deeply in a democracy where we are right now, and I'm a revolutionary, so, you know, I'm waiting for a moment where we can transform the system. But while we're in the system, we have to be able to work the system in our interest. And I think we don't realize how deeply our interests are tied to the political system, no matter what it is that we need or what it is that we want. You're talking about education. You want a good, we all want good educations for our children, where our children are not just going to learn what they need to learn to thrive, but they're going to learn what they need to learn to know who they are as people. That's tied to the school board, right? And the policies. Right now, they're running ramshod across the nation, getting rid of
supposedly CRT, which was never taught in schools, and DEI, which, you know, now they have these this whole anti-woke campaign really goes against the interest of our people. They're cutting African-American history, but yet now they're forcing Western Christianity in our schools. All of those things are tied to the school board. And while we were celebrating, the folks were in the lab creating the blueprint to eradicate every single game that we got after George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. We were out in the streets, and I'm a revolutionary. I do revolutionary teachings. I tell people, you never sleep after you win a battle. Because right. when after you win the battle, the and you know, Toy, the people in the cut planning,
they wait.
They're wait. Planning and strategizing. They're in the cocoon, and when they break out of the cocoon, everything is established. And so what did they do? They strategically placed people who were going to represent, as Brother Angelo said, represent their interest in these key positions to make decisions about not only the impact, not only their children and their people, but impact everybody else too. So when Angelo, when you were talking about, you know, an agenda, we have to have an agenda that represents our interest, and we have to be able to get close enough to each other to be able to create that social contract between all of us that we can hold the politicians in all of these different branches accountable for. Local elections are so important right now. Probably, well, right now the president is because of Project 2025, but the governor is probably the most important political position that we need, because what the feds are trying to do right now is they're trying to eradicate federal oversight. They're trying to dismantle the Constitution. They're trying to eradicate all kinds of federal laws and federal protections. And what they're doing is they're saying, we're going to let the state handle it. So what happens with that is that every governor becomes the president of your state, and yeah. you're bound to the governor in your state. I'm in Virginia. Governor Youngkin is the conservative Project 2025, you know, king. And if I were a professor in Florida right now with DeSantis, my ass would be in jail. So we have to understand how our interests are tied to the political powers that oversee the institutions that we have to in this. We don't have a choice. We have to be in this space. And so your senators, your state senators, your US senators, your school board members, your city council, your city managers, all the way up your House of Representatives to your governor, those are important positions. And again, I didn't start voting in local elections until a few years ago, because I, you know, in my revolutionary state, I'm waiting for the revolution and I'm plotting, but we still have to exist. So I would tell people, education-wise, that we have to understand that while we live in this political climate, our interests are uniquely tied to the people who are supposed to represent us. One. Two, understanding the vote. You don't vote blindly. Like, just because somebody is Black or a woman or whatever, that shit doesn't... Oh, I'm just cursing. Oh,
hey, look, we say fuck 12.
I'm sorry, y'all. Okay, so, yeah, like, we in the family room. But, you know, that those constructs don't matter, right? We have to be able, before we cast a vote, we have to be able to understand, one, understand what their agendas are. That's number one. Two, go research who's financing the individual's campaign, because whoever's putting up the most money, those are the interests that they're going to have to represent, because money doesn't come free. That's number two. Number three, when people are coming around to our churches and trying to get our votes, we need to have the agenda straight so that we can say, okay, well, we're holding you accountable for doing this. And Brother Angelo said it, Kamala right now, she raised over $200 million in 2 days. Ugh. Maybe, okay, not too. She had about 80 from one, and yeah. I don't know how much the men did.
Over 100 million.
Okay, I know I'm that part. Yeah. But our money also has to be tied to our interest, right? Part. Because in the past, whoever donated, it's like lobbying. I'm going to donate to your campaign, and the money doesn't come. This means that you're going to represent our interests. And so we have to understand the power of our votes. And we can only understand and realize the power of the vote if we understand the power of the vote. I'm not just going to vote for you. When I hit my vote, I'm holding you accountable to represent the interest, not just my personal interest, but the interest of my community. And to that, we also have to understand that while some of us may be privileged, everybody is not, you know, where we are. And so if I have a modicum of privilege, I can't just go in and say, I want you to represent my interests. I have to be the voice for my people, for our communities, for the interest that represents our collective. And so that's what I would say about voting and the grassroots of what we need to know and how we need to go about. We need to stop allowing, just like Brother said, stop allowing people to pawn us because we're traditional Democratic voters. We have to understand that our vote is power. And when we give it to someone, especially as a collective, then they owe and they're responsible. And then we have to have mechanisms to ensure that we can hold the people accountable for representing our interests. So I'll stop there.
And thank you for that. And you know, I would say it's not just DEI. They're trying to take back everything that has been legislated over the last probably about 70 years. We're talking about the 1964 Civil Rights Act. We're talking about the 1866 Civil Rights Act. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go look it up. Right. We're talking about every civil rights legislation that has ever been legislated. Mm-hmm. They want to take all of that back because when people think they give you freedom, they think they can take it away from you. Absolutely. But let me tell you something. Let me just say this or this. They never gave us freedom, so they can never take it from us. We own our own freedom.
That's right. And to that also, sis, I thought I got scared because I'm really in fight or flight mode as a Black woman right now, but I got scared because I thought our voting rights, I think it was in 2006. So I think 2031, Black people are the only people who have to have a renewal of our voting rights. And they just renewed it in, I think, 2006. And I went to a protest then. So, and they renewed it for 20, I think it might be 20 years or 25 years. If it's 20 years, 2026. It goes up for renewal again. If it's 25 years, then that's 2031. It goes up for renewal again. So if you have people in Congress who don't represent your interests when it's up for renewal, they can just snatch the right to vote away. I mean, and if you think about all of the strategies that they've used to try to deny us access, like if you have a felony, you have to get your rights restored to vote in a lot of different states. Interestingly, you have a presidential candidate who has 34 felonies, and he's able to, you know, like I'm trying to run the move. Like, you know, I think Brother Angelo, you're an attorney. Like, I think we need to run a class action lawsuit. Like, if you could run for president with 34 felonies, they need to set up voting booths and allow the brothers and sisters to vote behind the walls. I'm just saying, but that's just my 10 cents. So when you think about all of the ways that they have tried to disenfranchise people from voting, then you kind of understand the importance of what that means to the political apparatus. So, yeah.
But so I think that goes back to, like you said, though, you have to understand it, though, right? Like I said again, we're all from a different, I feel like we got a pretty good range of age range on this call, right? I think a lot of it goes to people don't understand it. I told my husband, when people be more comfortable, they put the signs on that said Negroes only and whites only, would they get it then? You know, it's almost like people want to act like they don't comprehend or understand, but they do understand. I feel like they just don't want to understand. You guys, when we keep going in the conversation, we're going to, we're joined also by Melina. She's here. Mm-hmm. Melina, you want to do a brief introduction of who you are, please? You come on the screen.
Hey, everybody. Sorry about that. I was coming from another Zoom and trying to get off, and you know how it goes. You know how it goes. So grateful to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me to the conversation. My name is Melina Abdullah. I'm one of the original members of Black Lives Matter. I'm co-founder of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and Black Lives Matter Grassroots, which is the boots on the ground for Black Lives Matter. We don't have million-dollar mansions or red carpets. We stand on front lines, not red carpets. And so that's the work that we do. My day job is I'm a professor of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA. I am a mama of three children, and I am a candidate for Vice President of the United States. I'm running with Dr. Cornel West, and pray to be someone, a daughter that my mama's proud of. So thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. So if you want to just chime in real fast, we're kind of just talking about the importance of voting, and being that you are running at the candidacy or not, Zoe has chimed in and Anthony has chimed in as well. We're talking about more so not just the importance of the presidential vote, but voting on the local side as well. Can you just kind of chime in on why that is important and why we have to educate ourselves on voting locally as well as for the president's also?
Sure. So we want you to vote all the way down the ballot, right? From the top to the bottom, right? I'll just give a couple of examples, like what impacts our life day to day is actually who runs things locally, right? So an example for us here in Los Angeles, I live in Los Angeles, is we spent 3.5 years trying to get rid of the former district attorney here. Her name was Jackie Lacey. She's one of those skin folk who ain't kinfolk. 838 people were killed by police in LA County under her watch. And she chose not to prosecute the police. So we said, well, then she got to go. And so every single Wednesday for 3.5 years, we stood on her at the front of her building. And sometimes there would be 5 people. Sometimes there would be 5,000 people. And we protested her every single Wednesday. And we ultimately got her removed. The new district attorney, whom we never endorsed because we don't endorse candidates as Black Lives Matter. The new district attorney adopted many of our policies. And so we have started to see some prosecutions. The murderer of Ryan Twyman was prosecuted. The murderer of Christopher DeAndre Mitchell is being prosecuted. And we have other prosecutions moving. The other thing that we've seen on the flip side is that we want our people who are in jail and prison unjustly to be released. So we had the longest serving political prisoner, Rochelle McGee, who was involved in the San Quentin prison uprising with George Jackson and Jonathan Jackson, who was only 16 years old when he went in and was more than 80 years old when he was finally released, was released by George Gascon, by the new DA. We also have the co-founder of our prison chapter at Lancaster Prison, who was released by Gascon as a policy that we advanced that if you were imprisoned as a child and then they held you into adulthood on what they call enhancements, you should be automatically released and your slate wiped clean. So Prince Akili went in when he was 15 years old. He was snatched out of his seat in high school. His mother never saw him free again until last year. He's now 33 years old.
Oh my God.
And he was arrested on a non-murder. It wasn't a murder charge. It was a fight in a mall, which is what I think a lot of 15-year-olds do. I know I've had fights when I was a teenager. Well, Prince Akili is now home. He is leading our Black August work for Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and on our security team. He's leading much of the security that we're building around our folks. So local elections are hugely important. We also passed something called Measure J, which allocates $500 million a year to non-carceral responses to community safety, things like good jobs and housing and healthcare and mental health resources. So voting locally is really, really important. And so we're always encouraging folks to vote, but we're also saying that it needs to be connected with our organizing. So our mantra is vote and organize, not just in November, but year round.
Yep, Angela was saying the exact same thing. He was saying pretty much that the vote has to match the agenda.
That's right.
There's no purpose behind it. It was almost like a wasted vote in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're on mute.
I'm just nodding. I put myself on mute because I do a lot of amening and I probably shouldn't be doing that.
I think one of the things that's too, that's so deep and we haven't dove into this yet is third parties. Like, I think that one of the things that we probably don't talk about enough in our community is other parties, right? And how that should be a part of our political strategy, political agenda. I remember way back when Cynthia McKinney and Rosa Clemente were running for president and vice president at the time. And it was the first time I had heard about folks who aren't Democrats or Republicans running for president and vice president of the country. And I happened to be in Georgia where Cynthia McKinney was at the time I was a college student, but it really transformed how I thought about politics. And I think when there was all the enthusiasm around Bernie Sanders, a lot of the enthusiasm was because he didn't seem like a traditional politician. And he seemed to be pushing an agenda that was even more so than progressive, potentially even radical. And I think a lot of people were excited. I know I was, because when he didn't get the Democratic nomination, I said he should run third party now, because there was enough energy behind him that you could actually now have a third party candidate who would have shook things up. And I think there are these moments, and I think we're in one now, where we have to really explore what it means to have alternative parties, how useful they are for us, not even just at the highest level, but also at the local level. Because I think we have to, in a very urgent way, think about all the ways in which we build political power, all the ways in which we hold other candidates and the apparatus accountable. When folks were talking, I was going back to my bookshelf and just grabbing books because I was like, you know, there's certain books that help inform me around politics. And one of the books, just in understanding political power, it's connected to economic and social power, is The Blueprint for Black Power. Like, this book I go to all the time just to help me or remind me about how power works and how it moves and what we're engaged in the political fight for. Like, it's about power in many instances for me. There's another book that I picked up recently. It's called Our Unfinished March. It's by Eric Holder. And he talks about how the vote has been under attack. And he really dives into it. He's calling it Our Final March because he talks about the ways in which we fought for it, how folks were speaking before, and now it's being rolled back, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this attack on the march or on the right to vote. Now, the other thing that I think is tremendously important, and we kind of talked about it a little bit, is the opposition, right? I think when you think about Project 25 and many other things, the opposition has its agenda, but not only does it have its agenda, it's very clear about how it's going to attack us.
Yes.
Part of their strategy and their tactics to attack us. So it's Project 2025, but it's also, like we said, attacking critical race theory, DEI, criminal justice issues, and giving law enforcement more money and more money, the expansion of the military. There are agendas, items that they have while they're attacking us. So it's kind of a sword and shield barrage that we're experiencing. And I think as we get clear about our agenda, what our agenda items are, how we strategically and tactically use them, we have to be also very clear about our opposition, what their agenda is, who stands with them, and what they're trying to do and roll back. Because I think you have to kind of be clear about your enemy. And for me, when I look at the attacks on critical race theory, DEI, and even Project 2025, it's white supremacy, right? And it's white supremacy without saying we're KKK, right? But it's attacking everything and anything Black, right? And it's attacking some of the systems and institutions that we've begun to build. And I often say, in order to confront the system, you got to build the system. There's no way around it. It's hard to confront the system as an individual. It's hard to confront a system, even as an organization. But when you start to begin to build systems, you can begin to go head up with systems. And I think they're very clear about that, which is why they're attacking some of the places or pillars where we began to system build. And I think CRT, DEI, are some of those places where they're like, nah, this can't happen at all. This has to be rolled back and rolled back fast because they know the power of it, right? And I think when you have those pillars in place, your agenda becomes clear, and now you're able to move your agenda forward. You're able to move your agenda forward. But if they backtrack our victories, what we end up spending a lot of time is just trying to gain traction on the initial victories.
Yeah.
What we've been thinking forward in future. So I say all that to say, I think it's very important for us to understand that this is white supremacy. We're still battling. We're still against. And they're very strategic about how they attack us institutionally. So as we understand their agenda, we have to understand their tactics and strategy of attack to protect ourselves.
I wanted to jump in and I wanted to say to Malina Abdullah, congratulations.
Yes, congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations. You just, and Angelo, you, I came out of voting moratorium to vote for Cynthia McKinney and Rosa Clemente. I swear, I just got finished talking to my sister about that before I jumped on the call. My mother was livid that I voted for them and didn't vote for Obama because they were up against Obama during that time. And that was my act of resistance. And I think the fact that Malina Abdullah is running for vice president along with Cornel West speaks to our lack of understanding. Audre Lorde has a quote, "The master's tools will not dismantle the master's house." Two-party politics is just a way of preserving the status quo. And the reality of it is that there are probably about 30 other parties with candidates who are probably representing, and I'm listening to Malina talking about the work that she's done. So, you know, there are parties that are representing our interests that we don't know about because the mainstream does not give them the platform to be able to let us know that they exist. And so, you know, we're always up against, you know, the two parties, the lesser of two evils, or Democrat or Republican, as if there's is no other party. And unfortunately, because we do exist in this space right now, that always serves as our detriment. Because if we understood that there were more parties and we did our research and we made the parties that are not Democrat and Republican, not alternative parties, but parties, period, that we should all have access to, then what that would do is it would keep the system a little bit more honest, right? So if people understood that Cornel West and Malina Abdullah are running, what party are you running? Independent? Green?
Justice for All Party. It's a new party. Is what we're running on in most states, Justice for All Party.
So Justice for All Party, boom. Then they have to get on all of the ballots because the next time I voted after my first time, my candidate didn't make the ballot in my state. So I could. So these are the ways that the system is designed to protect itself, right? And so the ongoing, I'm sorry. I don't. So the ongoing is that we have to understand that there are more than just two parties, and we have to start educating around that to set up for the next ones and the next ones and the next ones, so that we understand the options, so that we can truly vote for people that represent our interests and know that there's a possibility for the people who represent our interests to win, to actually win, and to keep them in the space that keeps the two-party system accountable. Because right now, nobody really has to be accountable. So I did want to say that you're present, because that's real powerful, and I'm really proud of you.
There are no balances right now. So I'm going to ask a question. Might be unpopular, but I don't care, because I want to know. A lot of people right now, Zoe, you said you didn't vote for Obama. And, everybody mama vote for Obama because he's a black man, right? So right now you have Ms. Harris, who's possibly going to be on the ballot or not. Melina, I'm not mistaken, you guys on the ballot, is it 8 or 9 places?
Currently 10, but it looks like we'll be on in 14 next week.
So my question to you is this then. I've read some unkind things about Ms. Harris as far as just her tenure when she was in California and the many folks that stayed in prison because of her being a prosecutor. You know, people might not say, you know, hey, not my Zoe Harris, but Kamala Harris, I'm saying. You know, they would say that, you know, because she dealt with things and whatnot, is she really for black people? I want you guys all to chime in on that as far as her perspective and her agenda as far as a black woman, or I'm sorry, she said she's mixed. She's not black, so she's mixed. So what is your perspective on that? Can you guys all chime in on that, please? Lena, you first.
You want me to go first? Yeah. Well, first, I just want to say thank you for the commentary we've heard already, and I hear Rosa's name coming up a lot. Rosa is one of my best friends in the whole world, and I just got off her Instagram right before, like a couple hours ago. I was just on her Instagram talking about this and talking about why she ran as a third party candidate and why that was important. She was one of the people that, before it was announced, I only talked to my kids, my parents, and my movement family, and then talk to Rosa, because who better to talk to than somebody who's done what you're considering doing, right? Especially when it's one of your best friends. So just spoke to Rosa, and she'll be happy to hear that you all raised her name. So I've been very careful to not bash Kamala Harris, and not just since she's been endorsed by Joe Biden and elevated to this position, but from the beginning, not bashing her. Because I think it's important, even when we had to get rid of Jackie Lacey, right? I had to pull some people back from how they spoke about this person who was terrible. And Sister LaToya, you know how terrible these DAs are who refuse to prosecute your children. Right? You know how terrible they are. And I also don't want to enable the kind of misogynoir that comes for Black women. Sure. So, you know, they had made these graphics of Jackie Lacey, and it was a puppet, but it kind of looked minstrelly. And I was like, nah, we ain't putting that out. We're not putting that out, right? Like, we're going to say she has to go, but we're not going to enable people who go way too far on stuff. And so that's what I wanted to be honest about with and careful about with Kamala Harris. So before she was vice president, people tried to ask me about her, and I'll be critical, and I want to tell the truth. Like, our campaign platform is truth, justice, and love. I'm always going to tell the truth, right? And I want to also be considerate and fair, right? So Kamala Harris, her track record as a prosecutor did put thousands of Black men in the system. And, You heard Roland Martin, if you were watching today, go, well, it wasn't tens of thousands. It was only 1,900. Okay. That's a lot of lives, homie. Yeah. That's a lot of lives, you know? There was evidence that she tried to suppress in a death row case, you know? We got to be critical about that. And then we can talk about her tenure as senator, where she received over $5 million in donations from AIPAC, which is, you know, what is it? The American Israeli Political Action Committee, which is the group that pays for pro-Zionist candidates and aid to Israel. And the reason that that's important is because, you know, this is, we spend hundreds of billions of dollars supporting Israel's commission of genocide against the Palestinian people, right? They are killing babies. They are literally baby killers, right? And they're admitting that in this current iteration of genocide that they killed 50,000 people, but that's the bodies that they've counted. There are, if you've been watching at all, we know that, you know, Gaza is rubble, and how many bodies are under the rubble. So they're estimating that at least 100,000 lives have been stolen. Kamala Harris is in large part a responsible party for sending bombs and sending money to Israel. But also when she does that, that is money that doesn't come to house our people, to feed our people, right? So we got to be critical of that. We also, I believe, and Dr. West believes in reparations, and I mean real reparations, like cash payment reparations, right? Kamala Harris is against reparations, and in her own words, any policy that only benefits Black people, right? So, you know, she's fine. She supported policies for Stop Asian Hate. You know, there is an international law, and my brother can attest to this, that it's a basic principle of international law that when harms are done, you have to pay to repair the damage. That is what the root of the term reparations is about. It is inarguable that African people, our ancestors, built this country. And stole it's stolen labor and stolen lives of our African ancestors, a harm that has not been repaired, and a debt, in Randall Robinson's words, that has not been paid, right? And so I want to be honest about that. I also want to say that she did one or two things, right? And so it's not all bad, right? That I think that the work that she's talking about, the importance of no matter how you feel about abortion, I don't want a state telling me what conversations, I'm 51 now, so I hope I never have to worry about that again. But I do have a, I do have 20-year-old and 17-year-old daughters, and I have a son that's 14, so it could impact him too, right? Mm-hmm. I want to be able to have those conversations. I don't want Ron DeSatan out of Florida determining what happens to the fate of my child, right? And so I think Kamala Harris's stance on us having control over our own bodies is really, really important. I also think going back to when she was Attorney General, and Sister LaToya, some of the people that you work with, I know, were killed inside as well as outside, right? And we have a really difficult time tracking killings at the hands of police inside our jails and prisons. When Kamala Harris was Attorney General in the state of California, she started something called the Open Justice Desktop, which allowed tracking of deaths in custody. That's something that every state doesn't have, that California has because Kamala Harris was Attorney General. Now, I shouldn't be, it's probably a strategic error to be lifting up the good stuff that she's done, but if I'm telling the truth, I want to tell the truth all the way around. In the end, she's running as a Democrat. And I believe, and Dr. West believes, that this two-party system is wholly owned by corporate interests, and it is completely irredeemable. It's beyond redemption, that they're always going to go for union busting. They're always going to go for stamping down wages. They're never going to support the Amazon workers. They're never going to support families who are fighting to end qualified immunity. I mean, the most the Democratic Party has tried to lift up is the, what are they calling it? The George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. Nothing in that act would have prevented the death of George Floyd, right? No.
Right.
And so, you know, we got to remember that it's not just about this personality or this personage of a Black woman, but it's about the Democratic Party that really owns her, right? And we have to disrupt that duopoly. So it's not personal against Kamala Harris. It's an acknowledgement that even if she wanted to, even if she all of a sudden became, I don't know, some radical, she's all of a sudden a Feeny Shakur, right? she's not. But let's say she all of a sudden transformed into Feeny Shakur. She is held in. How far she can go is controlled by a Democratic Party that is fundamentally white supremacist, patriarchal, capitalist.
All right, Zoe, you next?
I'm a tag team because that's basically the point. You know, the like Audre Lorde said, the master's tools will not dismantle the master's house. I mean, the two-party political system is designed to preserve itself. And that's just period. So, and that's the reason why I didn't vote until 2008 when Cynthia McKinney and Rosa Clemente ran. That was my resistance. Again, though, I think it's crazy for me, right? Because in my heart, when I'm listening to Sister Melina, like in my heart, I'm like, oh shoot, that's thing, you know, you got my vote. But because of this critical era we're in right now, I'm not a fan of Kamala. I know her track record. I've never been a fan. Everything that Sister Melina said is true. And, you know, those of us who study it know it and understand it. And unfortunately, I love the term. What did you call it? Is it duopoly?
Duopoly, yes, it's a duopoly.
Okay, I'm gonna cite you on that. Which means that the two parties have a monopoly over politics, right? And because of that, we're always faced with choosing like the lesser of two evils. And Project 2025 is really important. This is just to me. And because I understand the trajectory of the regression that we are going through right now, regardless, I feel like I'm stuck. That's how I feel. I feel like I'm stuck. My inclination would be to choose another party. I have in the past, but this right now is a critical era, and I, you know, for me, it's almost like an all hands on deck, and I don't know how that's going to turn out, but I know for the future, it really is about political education and getting us to move beyond two-party politics into understanding that there are parties that truly represent the interests of the people until an effective, transformative movement, revolution. I don't know where I'm going to go, something, because I don't see it happening here, but until something happens, when we know that our interests will be met. Because again, like if the interest is to preserve white supremacy, heteropatriarchy, and capitalism, and that is what it's designed to do, you know, you until you change that, until you create a transformative shift, undo it, break it down, and then rebuild it, it's always going to sustain itself. So I'm not disillusioned by anybody who is the president, because they're going to have to operate within the system. And if they don't, they're going to be consequences. And so because of that, as a, you know, as a Black woman who loves my community, I always know that there's always going to be a fight to ensure that people represent our interests as closely as possible. And again, I think with the money that the Black community is funneling into Kamala, you know, imagine if we funneled that money into Sister Malina and Cornel West. Like, imagine if all that money, see what I'm saying? Like, so, you know, and those are, when you talk about the future and going into the dungeon and mapping out, 2024 might be done, but 2028 is coming. We got 4 years to strategize and create a plan and an agenda, just like the Heritage Foundation did. You know, we got a Heritage Foundation too. We funneling all of that money, and imagine if we funnel all of that money into the candidate that represented our interests. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So I know that's ambiguous and I'm going all over the place, but I'll stop there.
Go ahead, Angela. No, I think so much has already been said. I think that, first of all, I love the honorable piece, right? Like being able to say what VP Harris has done that has been useful. I didn't know about the open justice desktop. I never heard of that. And in New York City right now, there's been 40 individuals since the current mayor, Eric Adams, has been in office, who died in DOC custody.
That's crazy.
40, right? And yeah, it's that we know of, right? Mm. That we know of because of either families who have come out or docs decided, the Department of Corrections decided to tell us. So we know how important that is and how much violence, police violence, happens behind the walls that we almost never hear about. So I would love to see that happen on a national level. That's tremendously important. But for me, and I say this to, you know, friends all the time, it would be hard for me in any circumstance to get behind a prosecutor. Because, and it's not just because of prosecutors, right? Because you might have a progressive prosecutor. But even when you have a progressive prosecutor or a prosecutor that cares, we know the criminal justice system is just racist. And the way the criminal injustice system moves, is it targets, it traumatizes Black and brown bodies. In law, that's exactly what happens. And for her to have incarcerated almost 2,000 Black people, we know that tens of thousands of families and individuals were impacted by that. Mm-hmm. And it also helps us really understand the power of DAs. The mm-hmm. idea that you could send almost 2,000 people to jail in your time in prison and your time alone is tremendous.
Yes.
And when you start to calculate that with all the DAs around the country, you understand the issue of mass incarceration and the impact on the Black community. So I don't think, you know, I don't think we should ever undervalue the damage that has been done and what that means to our community. So for me, I don't know if I can ever get behind a prosecutor, because I'm an abolitionist and I've done criminal justice work for way too long to support a prosecutor. But the other piece is that in her tenure as a prosecutor, she didn't do enough to show that she's going to stand against the system in a way that would be tremendously meaningful. And the reason why that is important is because, as was said, in many ways, when you become a candidate of the Democratic Party, you are owned by the Democratic Party. So if you don't have a track record that shows, as you become a candidate for the Democratic Party, you're going to fight them tooth and nail, I know that a lot of what you're going to do is just hold the Democratic Party's agenda at the forefront. And we know that the agenda of the Democratic Party as it stands does not serve Black, brown, indigenous, and oppressed folks. It just doesn't. And we're in a constant battle with them. Right. There's an ongoing genocide happening in Palestine. And I think some of the activism around trying to hold Biden accountable because of what his relationship is to the genocide in Palestine is what got him removed. So there has been a tremendous power in folks saying what the Democratic Party is doing right now, we don't stand for. And the unfortunate thing is that we constantly are building alternative power. Like, I think all the student movement and the Muslim community around the country that said, we're not with Biden under any circumstances, made the Democratic Party say, we got to do something different or else for us, right? But the interesting piece is now, in some ways, they've been able to pull us back in, even though the agenda hasn't shifted, simply because the candidate has shifted.
That's crazy. Yeah, you're right.
And that's tricky.
Yeah.
When the agenda hasn't shifted, but the candidate has shifted, and we all shifted simply because of the candidate, not the agenda, something about that to me means we're not being as politically savvy and sophisticated as we should be, right? We're not being as politically savvy and sophisticated as we should be. But the other piece to me is also showing that we certainly could have a viable third party. Because look at all the money that was raised.
Uh-huh.
Look at all the folks who moved away from the Biden campaign and forced him to step down. So not only do we have the social power to make them do something, we have the economic power to move them in the direction they want to move in, which means we could build whatever we want. And we know historically, too many decades and generations have come and gone to know that chances are, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party is not going to do what we want. And I think this is an important moment for us to kind of call each other in and talk about really what do we do and how we strategize. A couple of years ago, it was the 50th anniversary of the first Black political convention that happened in 1972. And the mayor of Newark, Mayor Ross Baraka, and the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, Chokwe Antar Lumumba, were talking about reconvening this space, right? Because of basically the roles of both of their fathers in 72. And they were talking about reconvening Black folks to have this discussion about our political future. What kind of political formations do we have? Do we need a Black political party? Do we have Black presidential candidates? Because in 72, Shirley Chisholm was running, right? And it was like, we constantly find ourselves in this political moment where we're saying, what do we do and where do we go? But there are existing political apparatus that constantly sway us, manipulate us, and use us when we need to spend some time focusing on what we do and our strategy. So I hope in this moment, as people are kind of, in many ways, very hysterical and excited about Kamala Harris, that we start to talk about what do we build? Because I am certainly very aligned with, you know, Malcolm's sentiment that I'm not a Democrat or a Republican, right? I'm one of the victims of the Democratic and Republican Party, right? And we haven't seen democracy. All we've seen is hypocrisy. I think that has been our experience by and large in this country, which would require us, as I always say, to do something different. Which would mean to lean into a third party. And I think even to understand the importance of what it means to have a third party. And as Sister Melina put in, she was like, if we get the threshold of 5% in most states, then you get a permanent ballot access. All of those victories are tremendously important to begin to shift the narrative of the viability of a third party, what it could mean for us, building agenda, why we should support it financially. So I think one of the things that should happen, given all the excitement around VP Harris, is that we should dig deeper and dive deeper into the third party conversation, right? And education of folks also around the importance of it.
And too, I think that 5%, because I saw that too, I think that needs to be a part of the agenda. Instead, I think that we need to get together as a people and vet the party for our people and start now to invest in the party for our people and do the work to situate that party, period, while we're playing in this this democracy. So, I mean, I think that that's really important, and I'm hoping that you run it back in 20 8 and maybe run for president or something too, since you will have my support. But I mean, I think those are the things that we have, because imagine if we established our own party and we knew that our candidate was going to meet our interest, and we invested all of that money into the candidate that we knew would invest in not just our interest as a people, because the things that we want as a people are what really everybody wants and needs, like, you know, economic access, the freedom to be, to actualize without restrictions, like all of, you know, all of the ideal things that everybody needs. But I think that that's something that's very important. But back to Kamala Harris, we can't give money and guarantee a vote without accountability. And the amount of money that has been raised at this point has to come with an agenda and accountability. And Project 2025 is the platform that people are rallying around, trying to block Project 2025 and the Heritage Foundation from taking a stronghold over America, which I'm still trying to figure out how that works, and why we're not suing them, you know, for our violations of the constitutional rights of everybody. I'm still trying to figure that out. But we have to, again, understand the power of our vote and understand the power of the money that we put into our candidates and have strategies to hold people accountable. Right. And this right here is the time where, you know, Black folks have proven again how powerful we are. And I think, you know, the next round, you know, we need to already have that train in the station ready to pull off.
Roxanne, do you want to say something at the top?
Well, I was like holding my mouth, but I'm hopeful that, you know, with this 100 million or however much that was raised in the last 2 days, comes some accountability that these, you know, I didn't get to get on a call Sunday, but that these calls include strategy, because just giving money is not it either. You're just, again, a pawn, to quote Malcolm X, in the master's house, right? But this has been a really good conversation. We've been going at it for an hour and a half. That's the other thing I would say. And we can stay here all night. Obviously, I would love it, because it's a very rich conversation. But we're gonna have to end it here.
Can I just make one quick point before?
Sure. Absolutely.
Yes. So, and I'm sorry, I know I hopped in late. Now I'm dragging it. So I'm sorry for that. But look, first of all, Sister Latoya, thank you for bringing me together with these people. I'm like, all y'all. I want all of y'all to be in my friend group. I hope I can be in your friend group. All of y'all are so, yeah. Don't you love when you get in the space with people who are courageous and visionary, and make it plain too, though, right? Like, I don't want them to just be so smart that they put it up somewhere and you go, what were they saying? No.
Make it real simple, please. Don't go over our heads with this.
right. One of the things I just wanted to say about Project 2025, one, I think it's being rolled out now in order to fearmonger folks, yeah. Right? Project 2025 has been written for 2 years. So now all of a sudden they're going, Black people be scared of Project 2025. Liberals be scared of Project 2025. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be alarmed and we shouldn't know what's in their 1,000-page playbook. We should know that. But we also have to have our own vision, right? Mm-hmm. So really what they're doing is saying, be scared of our vision. And I'm not a big sports person. I see you got I don't know if that's the jersey, but you know, but I do know this. If you play a game and you only play defense,
I knew you
you're absolutely losing. If you never have an offensive game, if you never say this is what you losing. And so I don't want us to become paralyzed by the fact that what's in Project 2025 is absolutely pure D evil, right? It is. And so what's in our playbook? What is our counter 2025? And so I think that we need to invest really more time in that than we do in their Project 2025.
And I just want to double down on that, because I've been saying to folks who, and I think it's important, we should know it. We should prepare. You got to know your enemy, all those things. But before that, it was the Tea Party. And then before that, it was this. And I tell Black folks, folks who have said it to me, especially white folks, I said, Black folks were slaves in this country. The type of things we had to deal with and overcome, I'm not going to let your documents scare me or frighten me to the point that I'm distracted from my agenda, what I'm doing. Yes, it's important. Yes, we should pay attention. Yes, we need to respond to it. But it's not going to become the center of my world, because I know that's what white supremacy constantly tries to do with all of its things. It tries to make its agenda, the things that we should be scared of. I want you to pay attention to this. And that's a big part of what's happening politically right now, even with VP Harris, Project 2025. They're forcing us to pay attention to things when we should be asking ourselves, what do we want to pay attention to?
There you go.
It's not to say that these things aren't important, but let's categorize it how we choose to, not how they make us. Because then we always fall into the same kind of space every 4 and 8 years. And I mean, you know, I'm not a spring chicken, and I've seen this happen way too many times. I'm just like, come on now. We've seen this play out before. We can't let this happen again. And I'm always excited when I hear about third party and I see third party candidates. And I think we should use this moment to mobilize people to have those conversations that folks were trying to have 2 years ago around the 50th anniversary of the last Black political convention. I think we should use this moment to say, let's come together and talk about this, right? Let's talk about the third party. Let's talk about why you love it or hate it, but let's also talk about the Democratic Party. Let's create a plan. Let's create a real plan and have real conversations about what's happening that are not distracting us or forcing us to focus exclusively on Project 2025 and VP Harris's potential presidential run. What are the things we care about? What are the things we want to focus on? How should we educate our folks? So that's the last thing I'm going to say. I hope that this conversation leads to more conversations with us and many more people about the things we discussed tonight. Love y'all. I appreciate y'all.
Can I just a last final
it's
word.
Because I'm scared. Okay, I'm scared shitless. I'm focusing on it because it is right now and we're at a crossroads. And I love it because it is the tension that always mobilizes. People don't mobilize without tension. So this is the tension that has mobilized the people. I think this is the time to harness around. They had a 50,000 member think tank. We need to get together and figure, if we don't get together right now and figure out what our counter Project 2025 agenda is going to be, if we don't get together right now and establish our third party and do what we need to do for the future, Kamala would be a placeholder. The work is yet to be done. And I'm looking forward to doing the work with you all to develop the counter Project 2025 agenda that Black folks need to have. And I think that this time is an awakening for us. And I think that we need to capitalize on the momentum of this awakening so that we will have our stuff together as well.
I say.
All right. Any final words, you guys, before we wrap this up tonight? I really hate the Dubs. Writing down, like, listen.
Take a break. Maybe we should name our project Infinity, because we're not just focusing on 2025. We're focusing on.
Better say that thing, girl.
and my infinity, we all there, chilling and free of the whole oppression suppression situation. We got a new situation. We free.
All right, guys, so before we wrap this conversation up real fast, Mel, I want you to throw on the screen. As you all know, we're talking about Project 2025, talking about voting rights as well. Everybody knows that Life After the Impact, we're about that action. As far as just, I won't stop. I won't talk. Mel, go ahead and play that. I'm sorry. A little intro video, you guys. So basically, you know, Life After the Impact, we're trying to, well, not even try, we are going to build a legal defense fund. So as we do see up there right now, everyone knows my story as far as having to write my case for Xavier myself. I got an attorney later on after the fact, spent about $63,000 of my own money, community money as well, to get a lawyer. So we're trying to avoid those things for other families as well. So be sure to not only tap into this episode and other episodes, but be sure to donate to our legal defense fund so we can continue doing this work as well. You all, I really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart for y'all always answering my thousands of questions last minute and always being willing to, you know, I said, I told them, they're TTG. Roxanne said, what is TTG? I said, train to go. They train to go. They ready to move, right? That's how we roll out. So as always, I think, you know, these can't just be conversations. Like you said, we have to actually be able to put these into play. So let's figure out, you know, how, Zoe, you know how many you rock already or not, but we got to figure out how to get everyone on that same page so that we're all having that same kind of mindset when it comes to third parties, when it comes to the two parties out here, whatnot. How do we continue to educate the community? So you all, please be on the lookout for possibly part two of this conversation. Be sure to get out and vote, not just for your presidents, but for the local elections as well. Make sure you're educating your community, your family, and having those important conversations about why it's important to be about that action and know what's going on within your community. Roxanne, you want to say some words there?
Yeah, I was just going to say this has been Life After the Impact. Find out how you can get involved. Talk to y'all later. Good night.
You can do it too. We have a visual of what we think an elected official is supposed to look like, where they're supposed to come from, the educational background that they're supposed to have. And I am here to tell you that you can do it too. And we absolutely need you. If you want to do the work, you got a heart for the people, and you're willing to get in there and be that voice, be bold. And like Jaleesa said, stand your 10 toes down, because sometimes you might have to stand by yourself and still be courageous and bold enough to do that, knowing that God will sustain you and keep you in that decision. You can do it too. I didn't think, and honestly, I didn't ask to be in this space, to be doing this thing, but it's necessary. Remember why you chose to serve the people, but at the end of the day, if I can do it, you can do it too, and we need you. We need you.
Everybody can do something that you don't have to sit home and feel helpless and hopeless.
We gotta stop allowing people to talk us out of our power. That's the main thing. Can't change overnight, but we gotta start somewhere. Might as well go ahead and start here. We didn't